Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Dr. Kiki's Science Hour is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Dr. Kiki's Science Hour with me, Dr. Kiki, episode number 113, recorded Thursday, September 22nd, 2011. Geek and nerd. This episode of Dr. Kiki's Science Hour is brought to you by Netflix. Watch thousands of TV episodes and movies on your PC, Mac, iPad, iPhone, or TV instantly, all streamed directly to you, saving you time, money, and hassle. For your free 30-day trial, go to netflix.com/twit. Welcome, everybody, to another episode of Dr. Kiki's Science Hour. I am Dr. Kiki, and this is the hour that we spend talking to an expert in something about science. And so I hope you're all ready to dig in, because we're going to get dirty today into the science of... Wait, science? We're going to be talking about geeks. We're going to be talking about geeks and science. Our guest today is the geek dad, Ken Denmead. And we're going to be talking with him today about a whole mess of stuff. I'm really looking forward to that. But first, as always, a few science headlines. Let's get to it. Researchers working with great and blue tits outside of Oxford suggest that the birds solve problems better as a group than as individuals. They used RFID tags to identify individuals in the flock and set up feeders with a series of levers that the birds had to pull in order to obtain sunflower seeds. Needless to say, the researchers needed to refill the feeders more often as the flock size increased. Creating a more efficient saltwater battery might be a matter of adding bacteria. A paper published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences details the creation of a water-based electricity source that uses bacteria to massively increase the efficiency of the system, making it powerful enough to liberate hydrogen. That's right, water-based, bacteria-powered hydrogen production. While the platinum-based cathode might make your wallet ache, rest easy knowing that at least the bacteria can eat on the cheap. People have become satellite trackers this week thanks to news that NASA's Upper Atmosphere Research Satellite has fallen out of orbit. It's going to return to the planet sometime this Friday or Saturday. The UARS should be mostly destroyed as it passes through the atmosphere, but some 26 pieces might be robust enough to actually survive re-entry and crash back to Earth. If you come across one of these pieces of debris, don't touch it. It's Evo. A study in the journal Neuron reports that zinc plays a crucial role in regulating communication between neurons in an area of the brain called the hippocampus, which is involved in the formation of memories and processing of spatial memory. The study also has implications for controlling the occurrence of epilepsy. In case you were wondering, the search for an anti-aging pill is going to take just a little bit longer. For years, researchers have followed the trail of a protein called SIR2, one of a family of proteins called sirtuins, in the hope that it might be used to extend human lifespan. However, a recent paper in Nature suggests that the protein pathways are more likely responsible for laboratory... are more likely responsible for the laboratory longevity effects observed in flies and worms. So it's very possibly something else. Gamers use the online protein folding game Foldit to discover the structure of a protein involved in retroviral growth called MPMV, retroviral protease. The protein is part of the Mason-Pfizer monkey virus, which is a retrovirus like HIV, meaning that the virus inserts itself into a host's DNA. Understanding how it is structured will help in the design of antiretroviral drugs. Quantum computers just came a little bit closer to reality. Computer scientists at UC Santa Barbara revealed the first quantum computer with von Neumann architecture like modern computers. The design uses superconducting quantum logic gates, a quantum bus, and stores quantum bits as counter-rotating currents in a circuit. computer still lacks substantial processing power, but the promise of massive parallel calculations is still there. And finally, physicists at CERN in Switzerland have reported news that could shake the very foundations of physics if correct. The unbreakable speed limit of light might be breakable after all. Neutrinos were detected arriving at an experimental detector some billionths of a second faster than expected, making them 60 nanoseconds faster than light. We'll see if this result is too good to be true. And with that, I'll take you to a word from our sponsor. This episode of Dr. Kiki's Science Hour is brought to you by Netflix. Netflix streams thousands of TV episodes and movies directly to your TV, directly to you instantly, which means you save time, money, and hassle. There are several easy ways to instantly access Netflix, these streaming movies and TV shows. You can watch Netflix movies and shows on your Mac, your PC, your iPad. You can even watch them on your iPhone or your Android device. If you have a gaming console, like an Xbox 360, a PS3, or a Nintendo Wii, you can watch Netflix right on your TV. If you're not a gamer, you can watch Netflix on your TV with an Apple TV box or a Roku box. They're pretty inexpensive and fairly easy to use, easy to set up too. And with Netflix, you can watch movies, TV shows instantly with any of these devices. Also, you can start on one device, and if something interrupts you, you have to go somewhere, you can stop watching and then pick up watching the show where you left off on a completely different device. So you're not tethered to one specific location. Whichever way you choose to access Netflix, you can watch as many movies as you want, any time you want, and you can cancel at any time. Try Netflix today for 30 days for absolutely free. Go to netflix.com/twit. That's right. Be sure to use this URL when you sign up for Netflix. Use netflix.com/twit. We thank Netflix for their support of Twit and Dr. Kiki's Science Hour, and we hope you enjoy watching instantly with Netflix. All right, back to the show and on to the main attraction. Today, we're talking geeks and science with Ken Denmead. Ken is a husband and father from the San Francisco Bay Area. This is according to the bio on his blog, where he works as a civil engineer. He's the publisher and editor of Geek Dad, the parenting blog for Wired Magazine's online presence, publisher of the companion blog Geek Mom, where along with a group of other dedicated geeky parents, he posts projects, book and movie reviews, weekly podcasts, and more about being a parent and being a geek. His newest book, The Geek Dad Book for Aspiring Mad Scientists, is going to come out in November. Ken, thank you so much for joining me today on the Science Hour.
It's great to be here. I'm glad we were able to connect this morning on Twitter and make this happen.
Me too. Yeah, it was rather funny. Funny story happened today on Twitter. I was searching for information about what Ken was up to because I was like, oh, I could talk to Ken and see if he would be interested in being a guest. And lo and behold, he was already going to be on TNT with Tom Merritt.
This is my day of twit. Right,
yes.
Here.
Yes, we're just going to keep you here. We just want to.
Has there
just
ever has there ever
Skype
been
a
guest on multiple shows on the same day at Twit? I wonder.
I don't know. I think that's a good trivia question. Chat room, check your trivia books for Twit.
Probably.
See if it's happened before. All right. So, science, geek, science. You're writing. You've written a book for aspiring mad scientists. Aren't nerds supposed to be scientists? What are we getting our nomenclature mixed up here?
Well, you know, it's difficult nomenclature, and and through having been, you know, running Geek Dad for so long and writing these books and talking to people from all over the United States and the world, you know, the terminology is actually kind of fluid. It's sort of like, you know, who calls soda soda, who calls soda pop, who calls, you know, geek means different things in different corners of the country and different places in the world. What we generally at the blog like to think of it as is you're a geek if you're obsessive about something, possibly to the point where it, you know, makes it causes you social detriment at some point in your life. And I think science can be a big part of the geek experience. You know, science fiction definitely is, and anyone who's deeply into science fiction usually already has a solid grounding in science fact.
Absolutely. I love the genre of hard science fiction where a lot of the writing actually does come from physicists who are
exactly, you know, I mean starting with Arthur Clarke and going forward with from the folks in the Golden Age, the people, you know, he was doing real science at the time that he was writing some fantastic stories, and he, you know, invented some real hard science concepts that are with us to this day.
Yeah, and with science fiction, we also there's the question always of which drives the other. Is it science driving science fiction? Is it science fiction driving science? And I really think there is kind of a an Ouroboros kind of effect. You know, the snake chasing its tail.
I definitely like to think that anything that we can imagine will be possible somehow someday through technology or whatever else. I mean, that's why I think you're seeing such excitement today over this announcement about the neutrinos. Whether or not there's something there, you know, half the people were going, "Wow, we found it." Half the people are going, "No, they've made a mistake somewhere." And I'm sitting on the fence right in between. But I like to think that this may be one of those situations where we've discovered something unexpected. You know, I think the coolest things that happen in science usually happen by accident. Yeah. And so whether or not this is actually these particles going faster than the speed of light, mm-hmm. or some other effect that we have not, you know, seen before, I kind of like the latter thing. I always assume that if we ever do achieve faster than light travel, and I think we will somehow someday, it's going to come through some accident where we discover some little loophole through the laws that we understand
loopholes
now.
In physics, you think there are
absolutely
loopholes?
Absolutely. Well, no, you know what, there's just stuff that we haven't discovered yet.
Yeah.
And you know, the pot into which all of that falls is probably, you know, so many orders of magnitude larger than the pot of stuff that we do know now, that it's just going to be a fun ride over, you know, over time, sorting all this stuff out.
Yeah. So let's talk a minute about the neutrino finding. The report was actually put out, but it's not, they're not saying this is an actual discovery yet, because they're interested in finding out what the rest of the scientific community, their peers, thinks about it. They're like, "We're stumped. We can't get rid of it."
They're playing it. I mean, this is good. They're playing it smart. You know, nobody's jumping up and down and saying we've figured something out, and that's appropriate for science. It's more a matter of, okay, you have a bunch of extremely smart people who designed a very specific experiment. The results of those experiments have left them scratching their head. They have probably spent days, weeks, months since they started seeing this effect trying to figure out what they did wrong, because it's going against whatever they expected out of this. It's completely different. So the first assumption is, and the best assumption is, all right, what did I get wrong first? Mm-hmm. And so I think they've probably exhausted their ability to review that and come up with an answer to that question. So now they're very cautiously stepping their toes in the water and saying, okay, we've seen this. We've repeated it. Mm-hmm. We've done everything we can do to figure out what could be wrong, and we haven't found anything wrong. So please, somebody else with the same equipment and know-how, try it and see what you get.
Yeah, there was according to an article on MSNBC, there's an experiment from 2007 at Fermilab that had similar faster-than-light results, but came with a huge margin of error. So they've seen this faster than light result, but the margin of error was too big to be able to say, okay, this is anything more than just a random occurrence, that this is our fault somehow.
But this time around, they've got a much tighter tolerance. And so, ooh, interesting.
Ooh, and it could overturn everything. Okay. As an engineer, science is a lot of experimentation. It's that search. It's like a toolkit, right, for figuring out how things work. And I think of engineering as like the application of that understanding. How would changing one of the main pillars of physics affect you and engineering?
Well, being a civil engineer, probably not a heck of a lot, because most of the stuff that I deal with has been sorted out and written down and built and fixed and built better over tens, dozens, hundreds, thousands of years. So at the ground level, not so much. Now, something on this magnitude, they've discovered, or they have potentially discovered, particles that can travel fast, you know, actual things with mass traveling faster than the speed of light. Well, first of all, we have to see what that really does mean, what it affects. Does that suddenly mess with every single other piece of math that has to do with the speed of light and uses C in part of its calculation? Yeah, maybe not. Maybe this is a very special situation. But again, you know, then there are possibly very interesting applications to it. If you've got, you know, is it just a set speed faster than light? Or, you know, this discovery that they were, what, showing up 50 nanoseconds, 60 nanoseconds,
60 nanoseconds
faster from point A to point B than the photons? That actually seems, what is that as a percentage of the speed of light? Where there's my question. We're talking this.
It's nothing. It's so minuscule, that actually is a point that a physicist brought up on a blog that I found. The reference frame. There's a physicist from the Czech Republic, Lubos Motl Pilsen, who has written kind of a rebuttal about this superluminal neutrino opera, and he said that they're looking at six times, so their margin of error was 10 nanoseconds, and they had the neutrinos arrive 60 nanoseconds, so six times their margin of error, which made it significant. But in the scope of things, it's this unbelievable number. Like, why isn't it bigger? Why didn't they get there a lot faster? Why is it not? He basically says, if it were going to be more believable as something that's true, that neutrinos can travel faster than the speed of light, that you'd think it would be much higher, much larger than their margin of error, at least a lot.
Yeah, I mean, how much energy were they putting into these neutrinos? What is, you know, there's a very minuscule but actual mass to the neutrinos, so you ought to be able to figure out, you know, what force does it take to accelerate them to a certain speed? How much energy were we putting? You know, there's lots and lots of math.
Yeah,
that they should be able to figure it out, but it's doing something crazy. I don't know. I think this is going to be interesting to see over the next weeks and months. You know, it's going to be a little heartbreaking if suddenly someone goes, "Oh, you forgot to move the one and carry the three and do that," or you know, centimeters versus inches or something like that. But
exactly.
On the other hand, that we could just be seeing the next step in an amazing. You know, first the science gets done, and then the engineer, you know, then it starts getting applied. And if we've got something here, you know, what does it mean for quantum computing? What does it mean for faster than light communications? Mm-hmm. Who knows? You know, you do Morse code with neutrinos faster than light. We could be talking with
with our grandmothers.
There you go. I like that.
You go faster. I mean, isn't the idea there? You go faster than light. You go back in time. So, you know, we could be sending neutrinos back in time to kill Tom Merritt's grandmother. Not that I would want to do that or anything, but yeah.
Yeah, we wouldn't be able to send messages back in time because nobody would be listening.
Yeah. We could send
Yeah. Now we can start listening and then see if anyone's contacting us from the future.
Exactly. We should. All right, physicists, get on it. Or engineers.
Engineers,
get on it. Build that neutrino detector for the the communication sector.
Dot, 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 dot. It's coming. Yeah.
It'll get here. Exactly. So tell me that, I mean, I love stuff like this. Tell us a little bit about, you know, what you do with Geek Dad, if people aren't familiar with the blog and you know, the kind of stuff that really gets you excited to cover.
You know, we it's... it's a very broad scope on Geek Dad, really. It's our mandate is whatever we as geeky parents find interesting, and it can be just geeky stuff, it can be just parenting stuff, or it can be that the magic intersection of the two. And so there you go. There's our blog for today. First of all, you're seeing, you know, the classic Dork Tower comic strip by our good friend John Kovalik, who writes all about gamers. You know, we love the role-playing games, the RPGs, the good board games and things like that, video game reviews. But we'd love to see the science stuff coming through, too. And you know, our biggest concern is we're happy being geeks. We have all of these interests that may not necessarily be in the mainstream, but are important. We love science and education, and we're trying to figure out the best way to impart these things to our kids in ways that they'll be excited about. And part of that is why the Geek Dad books came to be, because basically they are collections of projects, some of them that I've designed, some of them that were come up with by writers on the Geek Dad and Geek Mom blogs, that are things that you can do with your kids. They're sometimes zany, sometimes crazy games and projects, but usually somewhere buried deep in them are some scientific principles, something really interesting that you can learn out of the experience. For example, upcoming, you know, the one that's coming out in November, is actually full of specifically science experiments that you can do at home with your kids, from building the classic, technically, I guess it's better known as a foxhole radio, but we like to call it the MacGyver radio, because you can basically build it without power. You don't need power to listen to radio.
Yep.
And that's something that may actually surprise and shock some parents, and just be something really neat and cool to do with your kids, is just, you know, wind some wire around a few dozen times, and get the right kind of earphones, and tune it just right. You can listen to radio without needing a battery, without needing to power anything. There are ways to detect particles. You know, nice. Build yourself your own little cloud chamber.
Right. Is that using the smoke detector?
Actually, it's some frozen CO2. Mm-hmm. And just see particles decaying off of, you know, you can, it's funny and a little bit scary, but there's plenty of places online that you can buy
radioactive,
you know, safe
material.
Radioactive isotopes, yeah. So that you can watch this stuff. And so it's a bunch of projects like that. Things from a little bit of a hero's engine, so you can explain pressure and energy, to I don't know, stuff with light, stuff with water, watching playing with fluids. And the Diet Coke and Mentos experiments.
That's always fun. Do you do the? I know a microwave. You can use a microwave to determine the speed of light.
That was actually in my first book.
Okay.
Right. Just because it's such a cool experiment, and it'll knock your socks off that you can do it. You put a bar of chocolate or any piece of chocolate in there, and it can work with other materials. Mm-hmm. It doesn't have to be chocolate, but you know, it tastes better when it's chocolate.
It does.
You make sure it's not spinning around. You know, you take out that little spinny plate in the microwave so that the piece of chocolate will just sit in one place. And because of the way microwave ovens work, they're beaming waves that go up and down and up and down, and they meet and they create hot spots. And that's how it heats up the molecules in whatever food you're putting in there. Well, those hot spots don't move. Those hot spots stay put. And usually the food's moving around, so you're moving the food through the hot spots or moving food through the places where the hot spots can be created. You just have the chocolate sitting static. You're going to see hot spots pop up at regular intervals across the surface of the chocolate. Chocolate's easy because it's a matte surface, and you can very easily see where it starts to melt in these little points. So you measure the distance between every other point, and that's the wavelength of the microwaves that are being beamed at it. Use that. If you know the power rating of the microwave and one silly mathematical constant, and you can verify what the speed of light is.
Yeah, I think it's such a great experiment. It's like in your kitchen, almost everybody has microwaves, or you know somebody who does. You can, you know, actually verify the speed of light, which I think is just it's just great. I mean, that's hands-on science, which is, you know, we need more and more opportunities to do that. In terms of
with leaf blowers right now, because you can hear them outside here, but
leaf blowers work on. They're converting electrical energy to kinetic energy.
Actually, there's one more experiment in the new book. It's less than an experiment, more the practical side of building your own wind tunnel.
Oh, nice.
Using, you know, a fan or some sort of blower and just some piping and stuff, so you can make your own wind tunnel and then experiment on, you know, build the most aerodynamic car for your soapbox derby, not soapbox, the Pinewood Derby cars or things like that.
Or you could do like a bunch of hummingbird scientists did a couple of weeks ago. They recorded, they put hummingbird feathers, tail feathers, in a wind tunnel and then recorded the sounds that the feathers made, because the hummingbirds that use their feathers as part of the calls that they make, as part of the mating ritual. So, wind tunnels can be used for cars, planes, bird feathers.
Exactly.
Your little brother. I did not say that.
That might be where the we've got the a build for the Rubens tube in the book too.
I've made a Rubens tube. I have one at home. I love the Rubens tube.
That is so neat.
Yeah.
And what a visual, wonderful visual representation of sound and, you know, fire.
Yeah, fire. Exactly. So go ahead and explain the Rubens tube. I'm sure there are people who...
Yeah, Rubens tube, the simplest description is it would be a long tube. I think we use either PVC or... I'm forgetting the experiment right now. You close it at one end. You drill holes at regular intervals across the top of the tube, and you fit the bottom or side of the tube so that you can feed propane into it is what's commonly used. So you have a little propane canister along it. And then at the other end, you might have like a membrane of some kind. You can tape or rubber band over some piece of rubber or whatever, something fairly thin. So you turn on the gas. You know, you've got gas starting to come out of the holes. You light all the holes, so you've got basically, it looks like a bunch of little candles going across the top of this tube. And then if you take a speaker and start playing music, actually the coolest thing to do is you start with playing a simple, is that the 44.1 kilohertz tone?
Yeah, or whatever, pure tones.
A pure tone into it.
Yeah.
And because of the way sound pressure works from the through the diaphragm, the differential waves down of the pressure of the air that's inside, or the gases that are inside the tube, will cause the flames to shape themselves into a sine wave.
Yeah.
And then when you start playing music, you can actually get, it's like creating your own visualizer for
your own visual iTunes. EQ. Exactly.
Right.
Yeah. The Rubens tube I have at home is about, I think it was about 5 or 6 feet long. So
ooh, good size.
We get like one big long low wave, and then you get I think we got up to I can't remember how many times we were able to increase the frequency doing pure tones and getting actually well-defined waves. But we were able to go from one big wave, it was the wavelength of one pure tone, and then dividing it again by two every time we increased the tone. It was, yeah. Anyway.
What point do the animals start yelling out? Turn it off now, Mom.
Yeah, the Rubens tube is great. The microwave experiment is awesome. I was just thinking you could do chocolate and marshmallows and have yourself. It's the modern day s'mores.
Yeah, right? It's you know, the call for s'more science.
S'more science. I like it. So the book for aspiring scientists, you have before, the first couple of books are more like just geekier stuff. This is the only book that's really specifically science. Why?
Correct.
Why do a book that is specifically science?
Well, I mean, you know, with the first two books, there was always an undertone of science. It was, you know, there were games, there were just, you know, really straight geek culture sort of things. But what was fun in many of them was, okay, let's try and make sure that there's something to learn there and that you're sort of sneaking in the education so that after you've done it with your kids, you had an experience building together, you've had some fun doing something together, and then you could look back on it and go, well, you know what, I learned how this worked that day too, whether it's, you know, building just the simple electronic fireflies, so now you've learned how current can light up an LED, things like that, to more complex. And it just seemed right that, okay, let's do one that's more focused, because the point of all these books has really been, parents want to do stuff with their kids. They want to have fun exploring and doing projects with their kids. But so many times you run out of ideas. And so the idea for the books was, let's give people a whole bunch of ideas that don't cost a lot, that hopefully can be done with materials that you've got lying around the house, and that will both entertain and educate. And it came around to, all right, let's do one that's really more focused on that education aspect. I mean, there's still a lot of fun to be had, but this is also stuff that either, you know, parents doing it with their kids for the fun of education, or possibly these are good, crazy ideas to do an interesting science fair project.
Yeah, I think it's... I'm really interested in this interface between, I think, the geek tech kind of culture and the science culture. Observing so far, it seems like these are two completely different cultures, where there are science people who kind of are into tech, you know, because they use tech stuff. There right. are tech people who, you know, like the odd science story and everything, but they don't really mix that often. You don't really get a lot of the communication between the tech and the science. Do you see the book that you've, this particular science education book and the others that you've done, do you see that as kind of bridging the gap, bringing the worlds together? Sure. Someone has Space Bats in the chat room just said, the satellite hit Ken.
That's it. I'm so hoping, you know, having been very young but alive when Skylab came down, I'm still, you know, it'll be interesting if it came down somewhere that people could see it.
Yeah, it absolutely would. I mean, the probabilities are against it for the most part, but Northern England, the UK, Africa, there are some pretty large swaths of land that, well, the satellite could hit people.
We don't need it to hit people. We just, you know, we need to see some good camera phone video.
Yeah, and this is, I think this is the largest satellite to come down since Skylab. The largest U.S. satellite, anyway, to come down since Skylab. So it's a pretty
that we
big...
know of.
Yeah. Oh. All right, conspiracy theories.
You'd think with all the junk that's up there, we'd have rainstorms of bits and pieces coming down all the time.
Yeah, but I think that most of the time things either stay up there, or we know when they're going to come down, or it's too small, so it just burns up, and it'll never make it. I think it's only big news when there's a possibility of it actually making landfall, like this.
So we all have to run around screaming with our, you know, look out,
with our smartphones over our heads. I'll protect myself.
Now get the video and I can sell it to CNN. Yeah.
It's raining satellite. Look at this. I'm going to make $1 million if I live. Anyway.
Yeah, does your insurance cover that?
Satellite? Is that like an act of God? I don't know.
I'd be worried.
How much of the last question did you get before you disappeared?
Not enough.
Not enough. Okay. So
you were saying something really intelligent and then it went... Yeah.
That's pretty much how I ended it.
Oh, okay. Then yes, absolutely, I agree.
Yeah. So the question was, So I just observing there seem to be these two communities. There's the tech community and there's the science community. And you have science people who are kind of into tech stuff because they use techie gadgets and things. And there's the tech community who, you know, they like the interesting science story, like faster than light neutrinos and that kind of thing. But they don't really talk to each other, and they don't really, you don't have a lot of really gung-ho science enthusiasts in the tech community. I mean, they're not saying anything to people in the chat room. There are a lot out there, but yeah, it doesn't seem like we really have, it's like you're either all tech or you're not, you know, you're science or you're, you know, you can't be both. And do you see the books that you're writing, the stuff that you're doing as a way to bridge this, to bring the communities together?
I hope so. I mean, I see, you know, I think some of the people that are in between, or not necessarily people that are in between, but the people that are bridging the gap because they're from one or the other side moving into the contrary camp, you know, the makers. Mm-hmm. And because there's so many people that are either from technology doing interesting stuff with what's available open source, or there's so many people from science doing crazy stuff with what they know about and coming together at places like Maker Faires or, I don't know, Burning Man or a whole bunch of different places. And I think that's where our hope lies towards, you know, the two sides being able to communicate with each other and find common ground. And I'm really excited about having been involved in things like Maker Faire, and that these books are sort of geared towards popularizing that sentiment, that idea that, you know, sometimes we forget that we can do things ourselves. And right, that there's a lot to be learned to remind ourselves that we can be self-sufficient, and then that, you know, we're forgetting some of the basics about, you know, how the world works. And we should go back and try some of this, even the really easy stuff, the simple stuff, the, as I said, you know, making fireflies, which is basically taping an LED to a battery. There's something to be learned there. And once you know how to do that, you can add components and you can get bigger and better. And you've learned some science, you've learned some electronics, and you've built something. And I think that's where the twain can meet.
Do you think that there's value in the there? I know there's a movement beyond even just do-it-yourself maker type stuff toward the, we need to know how to survive when the end of the world comes. You know, the kind of apocalyptic view of technology is going to disappear at some point. We're not going to have it. You know, we have to know how to make a screw.
You know, I think that's sort of the postmodern equivalent of. Anyone who ever thought that, you know, Revelations was going to come and the world will end. I think there's something ingrained in the way our brains work, in our DNA, in our psyches, that says because we don't understand some things, sooner or later it's all going to go away. Mm-hmm. And we're going to have to go back. I mean, it's always been a fun. There are a lot of geeks who like to think, you know, that you know, we were all fans of MacGyver when we were young.
Absolutely.
And we all like to imagine that we have enough knowledge of science, of physics, and of practical building and making that, yeah, okay, if suddenly somehow, and this would need to be almost magically, all technology failed, we could still get by and build ourselves log cabins and create incredibly complicated aqueduct systems to, you know, match the services that we have these days. It kind of does amuse me a little bit, because has there ever been an event in history that we already know of wherein something happened other than, you know, war
or
to a lesser extent disease,
yeah,
that would really cause that cataclysmic a change in the way things worked? I mean, even if, you know, if California, for example,
fell into the ocean tomorrow.
Well, and that's not that likely. But if it was, yeah, you know, an 8-point earthquake, a 9-point earthquake, and you know, the freeways were all broken down and we can't get any power and the cell phone towers are down or whatever, that doesn't mean that civilization goes away. It just means that we are that first of all, we have crisis and crisis response, and we deal with the basics, and then slowly over time, we will get back to a certain point. People seem to think that it's like at some point, someone's going to hit a reset button and we're back to the Stone Age, and that's never going to be the case.
Right.
On the other hand, it doesn't hurt to know how things work, and it doesn't hurt to have the basic knowledge and skills to survive in that crisis period so that you and your family and the people that you care about will be able to persevere until things get better again.
Yeah. Do you think a scientific outlook will help people with stuff like that?
A practical scientific outlook. You know, it can never be all theory. It needs to be, you know, and of course, I would say that being an engineer.
Yeah,
but,
exactly.
But yeah, you know, theory is great, but practical application is what gets you through the day.
Yeah, so what's going to get you through the day is not necessarily the speed of light or whether it's faster or slower. It's going to be maybe knowing how much force you can put onto a beam when you're constructing something.
Exactly.
Yeah. In terms of the propagation of science and techiness and geekiness, you know, what more are you going to be looking at doing? You've got the Geek Dad blog that you edit, you publish. You've got books. You've got the Geek Mom blog as well. Are you moving into movies soon?
Actually, this is the bizarre experience that running Geek Dad has been. There is actually potential for a movie. It is in development. We'll just put it there. And my dread is that it has nothing to do with science and it just becomes a silly family comedy. But my hope is that it would be able to be instilled with, at least on the sly, some of the science and really interesting creative things that people are doing and building these days. So, you know, we'll see where that goes. That's entertainment. That's magic. I want to continue evangelizing this movement. This, you know, geek is popular right now in some way, shape, or form. And, you know, knowing the way culture goes, it will fade again, and the geeks will once again be shoved into lockers and
no,
ignored.
Say it isn't so. No, but we'll rise up.
There you go. The geek shall inherit the earth.
Exactly.
Well, as long as we're running the tech companies, maybe we'll be okay. But you know, I want to make sure that you know people understand that science is important. Technology isn't something to be afraid of. One of the big, you know, most common questions that we get asked when we do panels at various places is, you know, how do I deal with the fact that my kids have cell phones and you know, there is no etiquette established for a lot of the stuff that's happening these days because we're getting new devices with new capabilities like every month. So I try to give people a sense that whilst the tools are changing, the sort of the activities and the goals and the ideas are the same as they were 50 years ago. You know, all right, your kid has the ability to talk on the phone that's in their pocket now rather than the daughter in the classic sitcom having the phone with the 50-foot cord trailed up the stairs and sitting in a room with the door closed. Kids want to communicate, and so you got to figure out how to make that work within an appropriate framework.
Yeah, I think a lot of it comes down to also, you know, teaching kids, if you're teaching them values, if you're teaching them, you know, how to communicate with within society's rules, being polite, being, you know, having respect for others. I mean, that translates to technology. It's not,
right.
You know, that's not, technology is like this separate. I think when it comes to questions like, you know, like how behavior, how do you behave? How do we teach kids to behave? It's like I don't think you separate the technology out into its own little category.
Yeah, you don't take the technology away. Just, you know, teach them how to use it appropriately.
Mm-hmm. Teach them how to be a good person.
Right.
And then
they'll completely ignore you and go out and get 15 piercings, 12 tattoos, and, you know.
That's what I did. My dad was like, "No earrings." So I got
drink bad coffee.
Pierced.
You know, it's
no more than one pair of earrings. Okay, I'll get my ears pierced a number more times. Yes, that didn't go over so well, Dad.
Yeah, I remember, you know, it's not in there anymore, but I remember when I came home with that pierced ear and my folks were like, really?
What is
Wait
this?
Till your grandmother sees this.
Yes. So, yeah. How many kids do you have?
I have two boys. They are nearly 12 and a little older than 13.
And how long have you been doing Geek Dad, the blog?
It's about 4.5 years now since I actually took it over. It was actually started by, you know, Chris Anderson, the editor-in-chief of Wired Magazine.
Yeah.
Yeah, he started it as sort of a little pet project to go over the projects he was doing with his kids and with his friends. And he's big into unmanned aerial vehicles. And so those were the projects he started out with. And I got into it pretty early just because it was, you know, the perfect fit for me. And after a while, he decided it was becoming too much for him. And I was the lucky recipient of his entrepreneurial spirit. And it's been an amazing ride since then.
Yeah. Obviously, a lot of it is taken from what you're doing with your kids and how you're interacting with them. You know, how often is there just, you know, something that happens that you're like, oh my goodness, this thing I never thought would happen, you know, with my kids. The kids said something, or this project came up that we never even thought we could do, but we did. Like, how often do these surprises happen when you're putting your blog together?
You know, every now and then. I mean, there have been things, and they're not always sciencey, but they're cool. And my kids never cease to amaze me with the ideas they'll have, completely separate from anything I've ever taught them. You know, for example, my older son, back when he was in fourth grade, and if you ever lived in California, one of the educational standards here is in fourth grade you have to do your mission project, some sort of project
doing that. Yeah.
Having to do with the California missions. Mm-hmm. And usually, you know, there's in any hobby shop in California, you can go buy prepackaged model kits to build your California mission or some other thing you're going to do. And my son at that time was a huge fan of Ace of Cakes. So he decided to make his mission out of cake.
Cool.
And so we explored what the materials were. We had, you know, we had a local bakery that we really liked, and we talked to them about it, and they let him come in and use their restaurant grade airbrush for coloring things.
Oh, that's
and
neat.
He built this awesome cake model of a California mission, and so I had to write it up for the blog, and it actually made it in as a project in the first book. And it's things like that that just, you know, kids are awesome.
Kids are totally awesome. You have two boys. How many of the other writers for Geek Dad, Geek Mom have girls? And do you see a difference in the way that projects are done with girls versus boys, or is it pretty equanimous? That's the word.
Yeah, I think that's the right word. You know what is an interesting sentiment and almost a movement inside the geek community, at least the circles that I all these folks that I know is, and there's a great T-shirt on a site called Think Geek, if you know them. It says self-rescuing princess.
Nice.
And that's what you're seeing. That's what I see in a lot of geek parents, is that you have girls, and on the one hand, absolutely, they're women. They're young women. They're going to grow up to be women and have all of the likes and wants and, you know, personality traits that are appropriate. On the other hand, we don't. Whilst there's a societal, you know, hook towards pulling them to being princesses and being and this concept of the defenseless woman who needs someone to save her, we don't like that. That's not real. That's not practical. That's not, you know, it's not a way you want your kid to grow up. You want your right. kids to be self-reliant. So we want the girls that we're raising to be as smarter than the boys in science and math and building things and doing things for themselves and being creative and so forth. So we want self-rescuing princesses.
I think it's a fabulous sentiment. And so for all of you out there who are interested in self-rescuing princesses, you have to go to wired.com/geekdad. You can go to, it's also geekdad.com. There's also Geek Mom if you are a mom and you want to find out geeky things that that moms are thinking about. That's a great resource. And I think Carrie Byron writes occasionally for Geek Mom, doesn't she?
She does. It's been wonderful. Every month or two, she will write a piece for us. And she's so much fun. She is so cool.
Yeah, she's absolutely fabulous. She's got a new science program that's for kids that's promoting science, and you know, we've got I just love it. There's this, like, I think you and so many other people are out promoting self-reliance, intelligence, questioning, you know, the world, trying to figure things out for themselves, you know, the ethics of science and technology and geekery and nerddom.
Exactly. Reminding people that science isn't mystical. It's not, you know, when it boils down to it, a person who is a scientist is someone that follows basic steps to figure something out. And that's it. That's the entire description right there. And so when you get your blood boils about people in politics or whatever, being negative about scientists saying this or that, you know, it you got to shake your head, because you know what? There's nothing wrong with scientists or science if it's done correctly.
Yeah.
It's independent of what your opinion is.
Yep, absolutely. Let me look at your workshop back there. So do you have any amazing? I've been kind of glimpsing the background. Uh-oh, you're losing.
Oh, the Death Star just fell away.
But, not the Death Star.
Although there is that Death Star too.
Nice. Have you seen the comic that was? What's the planet that gets blown up by the Death Star?
Yes. Oh, the animated GIF of Alderaan shot first.
Yeah.
I think that's fantastic. There's so science-y stuff. This is actually a proper Diet Coke and Mentos.
Trigger loader.
Nice. Actually sent to me by the guys at EB Bird.
Nice.
Those guys are awesome. They're a ton of fun. And yeah, there's a bunch of, here's the Skitterbot.
That looks
fun. Basically it is motor. This was actually something we picked up and built at Maker Faire. It's simple spinning motor, but with the, you know, two regular legs. And one leg is the spinning motor, so it just all over the place.
You put it together, assemble it yourself, and then it's a bot.
Yeah, they had kits, and all the kids were building them at Maker Faire. So there's all sorts of, I've got a geeky wall of shame up here that's just, yeah.
It's awesome.
Yeah.
I think all geeks out there should have a geeky wall of shame, and they should submit those pictures to Geek Dad so that everybody can share.
That would be a good one. Actually, we shot a video here for Wired last week, and we used it as the backdrop. So it'll be online pretty soon. You'll be able to see all my Stargate and Battlestar Galactica stuff. And there's a Dalek up here. There's Robbie the Robot. You know, all the good stuff.
All of it. Thank you very much for joining me today, Ken. This has been a lot of fun. I've really enjoyed talking with you.
I'm so glad I was able to finally come on, Kiki. I've been following you on Twitter and all your stuff for so long. It's finally great to have a conversation.
Absolutely. So geekdad.com or wired.com/geekdad. Is there any place else that people can follow you online? I know you're on Twitter.
Twitter handle is Fitzwillie, FitzWillie. You can check out more about the Geek Dad books at geekdadbook.com. And yeah, that's pretty much everything.
Awesome. All right, everybody. I'm Dr. Kiki, and this has been the Science Hour. Dr. Kiki Science Hour, my Science Hour, but you know, it's shared with you. So it's really your Science Hour. Next week, we're going to be talking about squids. That's right. I do like a good squid. So we'll be talking about squid next week. And until then, you can follow my science-y pursuits around the internet. Dr. Kiki on Twitter. I am Kiki Sanford on Google+, because they do not.
Because you can't be Dr. Kiki.
I cannot. I cannot, even though there are tons of doctors on Google Plus who have not been. Yeah. Anyway, we won't go there. Right. Facebook, I also have a Dr. Kiki page, and you can email me at drkiki@drkiki.tv. You can also go to my website, drkiki.tv, if you're interested. So until next week, thank you for tuning into my Science Hour. Remember, all I ask is 1 hour a week. I do hope that it makes your world a whole lot more interesting. I'll see you later. And now, for your science meditation of the week.
There we go. So, what are we really made of? Dig deep inside the atom and you'll find tiny particles held together by invisible forces. Everything is made up of tiny packets of energy born in cosmic furnaces.
The atoms that we're made of have negatively charged electrons
whirling around a big bulky nucleus.
The quantum theory offers a very different explanation of our world.
The universe is made of 12 particles of matter, 4 forces of nature. The universe is made of 12 particles of matter, 4 forces of nature. That's a wonderful and significant story.
Suppose that little things behave very differently than anything big. Nothing is really as it seems. It's so wonderfully different than anything big.
The world is a dynamic mess of tingling things. It's hard to believe.
The quantum theory is so strange and bizarre. Even Einstein couldn't get his head around it.
In the quantum world, the world of particles, nothing is certain. It's a world of probabilities.
The quantum theory offers a very different explanation of our world.
The universe is made of 12 particles of matter, 4 forces of nature. The universe is made of 12 particles of matter, 4 forces of nature. That's a wonderful and significant story.
It's very hard to imagine all crazy things that things really are like.
Electrons act like waves. No, they don't exactly. They act like particles. No, they don't exactly.
We need a theory of everything.
We need a theory of everything.
Which is still just beyond our grasp.
Still just beyond our grasp.
We need a theory of everything.
We need a theory.
Perhaps
the ultimate triumph.
The ultimate triumph of science.
A very different explanation of our world.
The universe is made of 12 particles of matter, 4 forces of nature. The universe is made of 12 particles of matter, 4 forces of nature. That's a wonderful and significant story.
I gotta stop somewhere. I'll leave you something to imagine.
And I use my super ninja skills. Whack, whack, whack. Hi-ya! I just made the shark happy. Mm-hmm.